Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The reality we live in can be a very strange place. Most of the time, fact being stranger than fiction. How will we ever start to understand this reality we live in unless we question everything? Join me and a guest as we unravel the mysteries of this reality, one topic at a time. This is Icarus for Reality with Shane Jones.
What is up, inquirers, and welcome to the expanse of deep, open-minded conversation. I'm the one they call Shane, and in today's discussion, we uncover some of the dark history that lingers in America's past and the cause and effect it has had on our folklore. And of course, we dive into some of the wondrous creatures that are birthed from it. But before we get into that, we of course have to do the front of house. So if you aren't already following the show across social media, highly recommend that you do if you want to get updates on anything new and interesting going on with the show. Of course, Instagram is the one I'm the most active on, but you guys can check us out on Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Discord. And as far as Discord goes, it'd be really cool if some of you guys hopped in on there. There's a lot more going on in the Discord. I'm trying to build that up as much as possible to form a community of all of you awesome people out there. But the only way I'm going to be able to keep making that work and keep doing that is if you guys hop in, do some interaction, become part of the Inquirer community / Bizarre Encounters. I guess it kind of accompanies all of it, but definitely if you guys want to have some awesome conversation with some like-minded individuals, definitely go and check out the Discord. Can't promote that enough. And if anybody's interested in being a guest on the show, or having me as a guest on your show, or if you're interested in sponsoring the show in some way, shape, or form, or if you just want to have a conversation with me, you guys can get a hold of me through social media. Instagram is the one I'm the most active on, but you guys can definitely message me on Facebook also, or you guys can email me at inquiriesofourrealitypodcast@outlook.com, or you guys can go to the link tree, fill the submission form, and of course, that goes directly to my email. And make sure you guys check your spam or junk folders, make sure nothing gets missed in the process, because again, I do respond to every single message that I get from you guys. And if you guys have an encounter that you guys want to report, no matter how big, no matter how small, paranormal, cryptids, aliens, UFOs, anything anomalous, anything interesting like that, you guys can report those to omm encounter reports@outlook.com, or you guys go to the link tree and there is a separate submission form for that. I believe it's the third tab down. It says report an encounter. And depending on what you want to do with it, we can have a little bit of back and forth. Either one, I can read it on the show, give you guys a shout out, or we can just discuss it one-on-one, or you guys could possibly be a guest on the show. Or if I'm somewhat near you, maybe I can even get out and be able to investigate it. But if you guys want to keep the encounters between us, that's definitely possible. We can just have a discussion about it. Maybe I can help you out with it a little bit. Or again, if you guys want to get featured on the show, just let me know. And of course, like I said, we'll have some back and forth if you guys shoot me a message about any of that. And if you guys can't get enough of the weird stuff I do, you guys can go and check out Bizarre Encounters, my other show that I do with my awesome co-host, Oren. We deep dive into the paranormal, cryptids, aliens, anomalous things, anything weird like that. We do our own research on stuff. We have some back and forth. We have some fun discussions. Sometimes there's guests on the show, but it's a little bit different of a format. That sounds like something you guys might be interested in. Definitely recommend going and checking that out. If you guys want to keep tabs on everything I do all in one place, you guys can go and follow Open Minds Media across social media. And if you guys want to support the show, there's a couple different ways to do so. Number one that I'm trying to build up as much as possible is the Patreon. You'll get things over there such as ad-free episodes of the show, early access to the show, lives of the show, live replays of the show, exclusive merch store discounts, exclusive giveaways, Patreon exclusive shows such as the other show that I'm starting up, Bizarre Inquiries, and the first unofficial episode / first episode are already dropped on the Patreon if you guys want to go and check that out. I believe some of them I'll probably drop onto the normal feed to get you guys over there if you guys aren't already checking it out, but yeah, there's going to be a lot of exclusive content going on over there. And I'm going to keep trying to build that up as much as possible as far as 2024 goes. And if you guys have any suggestions for the Patreon, I'm more than happy to hear them. I want to try to give you guys what you want as far as that content goes. And at least over there too, you don't just get one show. You also get Bizarre Encounters and any other shows that I do all in one place, Open Minds Media Patreon. And if you guys want to donate to the show directly, you guys can do so through Cash App, Venmo, PayPal, or Red Circle, which is the RSS host for the show. If you just want to buy me a coffee to make it so I can stay up late and keep editing and doing all the different stuff for the show, definitely appreciated. Majority of that's going to go toward being able to get out to more events, to be able to meet more of you guys, make more opportunities as far as possibly speaking at events, stuff like that. It all goes back into the show because I'm trying to continue to build up and grow the show as much as I possibly can this year. And the third way you guys can support the show is through the Open Minds Media merch store. Over there, I got designs for Inquiries of Our Reality, Bizarre Encounters, some other cryptid designs. Definitely going to be updating as far as different holiday designs. There's always going to be something relatively new on there. I'm going to try to drop new designs monthly. So if you guys want to go and support the show, it's an awesome way to do so. There is random promo codes that get dropped on the Instagram and stuff here and there. And of course, if you guys join the Patreon, you guys do get exclusive merch store discounts depending on which tier you guys pick. And number four, as far as supporting the show, you guys can do so through leaving a review or rating on iTunes or Spotify or whatever other podcatcher you use. And if I can find that review, which I definitely check frequently, I will, of course, read it on the show and give you guys a big shout out. If you haven't already, highly recommend going and checking out I Know Squatch. They got a lot of really awesome Sasquatch type gear. They got their really cool exclusive creeper design, and they also have these really cool baseball looking hats that say the word whoop on it, of course, which for everybody that's familiar, that is the call of the Sasquatch. And for any other cryptid that you guys might want to be might be interested in, including Sasquatch, of course, but done in a totally different manner, you guys can go and check out Cryptotheology. Joe is always dropping new awesome designs, and I know right now he is in between convention season, so he should be dropping a bunch of awesome stuff really, really soon. He sent me a couple different things he was working on, and guys, I think you guys are really going to enjoy some of the new stuff he's going to be dropping very, very soon. And to all my paranormal investigators out there, don't forget to go and check out the Chattergeist. It is the all-in-one paranormal investigating device. I use it anytime I go out. It is my personal favorite device that I have at my disposal. And if you guys have any questions about it whatsoever, you guys can message Barry over there on Dimension Devices. He is the guy that programmed and developed it, of course. So we can answer literally any question that you might have on the device. And of course, don't forget to use our affiliate link if you go and pick yourself up one of those. It helps out the show immensely, and I greatly appreciate it if you guys would. And everything that I mentioned is all available on the link tree, which is available down in the show description. And with that, let's get into the show. Please welcome to the show, author and researcher, Susan Fair. How's it going today?
Hello, it's all good. How are you?
Not doing too bad at all. This is the second show I've recorded today, so I absolutely love it when I get to do stuff like that. It's like a little bit of a warm-up and everything. And it's also super cool to reconnect with you after meeting you back at that Cryptid Halloween event that Dave / Snarly Yow put on. So I always love it when I can reconnect with people and have people on the show after meeting him at conventions.
Yes, it was super fun, super fun. He did another one for Christmas, like the week before Christmas. I think it was a Krampus Christmas market, and I attended that. I didn't vend there, but I attended and did a lot of Christmas shopping there.
I would have done the same. I saw him post a bunch of pictures of it. I saw he had like that setup where it was like a photo booth or something, or you could take a picture with like Krampus or something.
Yeah, super fun.
I wish I could have made it out to that. I told him maybe next year I can make it out, but just because of Christmas falling with the kids and everything, I wasn't able to make it that one, but it looked like a lot of fun, and I regret not being able to go this time.
It was packed too. Definitely packed.
Dave definitely has a way with people. He can draw everybody in because he's just such a wonderful, nice, awesome dude.
He is super friendly and easygoing, definitely.
So considering that, you know, I had met you there, I know that Oren, my co-host on Bizarre Encounters, bought a couple of your books and everything like that. To get everything rolling, why don't you let people know a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what you do and a little bit about your books?
Okay, well, I am here in Western Maryland right now, actually Boonesboro, Maryland, in Washington County. And I am recently retired from a very long career with the public library system. And I've written several books. One is Mysteries and Lore of Western Maryland. And one is called American Witches, a Broomstick Tour Through 4 Centuries. One is Pilgrim Confidential, Shocking True Stories of the Pilgrims in the Strange New World. And one little one of Maryland Spells. So, and I've always been very interested in weird things, like most of us who get involved in this kind of stuff, like just started being interested in it when we were kids and watched In Search Of and all that kind of stuff. And it's a great way to kind of connect with history, I think, because you find out so much about the history of a place when you're trying to research its legends and weirdness. And I think reading like first-person accounts from history, especially like early American history, is like what I enjoy the most.
All the colonial paranormal folklore stuff, that's my bread and butter too. I absolutely love hearing about that stuff.
Really? Oh, excellent. Yeah. I mean, times were rough back then. I mean, they were very dark days for sure. And, you know, a lot of dark moments in American history too.
Creates a lot of dark, really interesting folklore all the same though. Because, I mean, it's their way of rationalizing and trying to understand the weird things that are happening around them. I mean, whether you believe in the paranormal or not, there is definitely something that needs to be understood through some type of paranormal paradigm.
Right, right. And when, like, the Europeans first started coming, you know, to America, they had, like, no idea what it's such a, you know, a huge country, and they had no idea what was out there, you know, so couldn't rule out monsters, that's for sure.
Talk about the whole idea of arriving to a new land and not knowing where the other side of it ends. It's just an endless, vast area of who knows what could possibly exist there. And it's hard to like fathom that now, just because of, you know, all of us pretty much knowing like generally like what a map of the world looks like, even if there is some stuff that may not be marked as far as islands, and not getting into conspiracies, but people claim there's land masses that aren't marked. But just the whole idea of just arriving in a new place and not knowing where it could end. Like, it could be 5 miles in that direction, or it could be a couple thousand miles in that direction. You have no idea. And in between, exactly, who knows what other animals, creatures, all of that stuff could exist in between.
Exactly. Exactly. I think in the very beginning, like, people who came to Jamestown and even earlier, like, they thought that there was going to be like some little shortcut, you know, that took you straight across this continent and, you know, right to where they were set up to like trade with, you know, China and everything. And, you know, was not to be, but
I still like the whole fact that they landed here, and originally they thought that they had landed in India, so they started calling the natives Indians, and that terminology still gets used today, which is just absolutely baffles me, that the whole idea of why they called them Indians was out of essentially a mistake of thinking that they landed in India. So it's like, why do people still use that context and wording for it? I don't understand.
Yeah, we definitely have a history of a lot of ignorance when it comes to the indigenous people, you know, who were here in this country, you know, in this land, I should say, before, you know, thousands and thousands of years before, you know, people came from Europe.
And all of their sites that they didn't know how to understand, they just put the word devil on it. Just called it a day.
Exactly. Exactly. That's for sure.
So I know I really want to get into some of the local folklore as far as Maryland goes. But before we get into that, of course, if you don't mind, I'm sure that people that would love to check out your books, if you want to kind of give them just like a quick idea about what each of your individual books are about. And then after that, we can kind of get into the meat and potatoes as far as Maryland goes.
Oh, okay, sure. The little one here, Maryland Spells, this was just kind of a compilation of a lot of weird folklore and spells that were used back back in the day in Maryland. Just a random one that I opened to. If you touch a corpse, the ghost of the dead person will not haunt you. So that's good to keep in mind. Could come in handy. I don't know. I haven't tried any of these myself. So
I wonder if that's where that whole idea came from, that at like funerals, they leave the casket open and people say their goodbyes and they like touch the body and stuff. I wonder if that's like where that originated from, was this belief that if you touch the body, that it wouldn't haunt you after.
I don't know. I guess that's possible. It's possible.
Just in case, to be safe, make sure that everybody who goes to a funeral, if you think it's somebody that might haunt you, if you had like a weird uncle or something, just give him a poke.
Yes. Yeah. Can't be too safe. And this, the one, Pilgrim Confidential, I actually wrote to coincide with the 400th anniversary of the founding of Plymouth Colony. Unfortunately, their whole entire 400th anniversary got quite disrupted up there by COVID in 2020. But it's definitely very interesting era, the founding of Plymouth. I mean, when you consider like half of the people who came on the Mayflower, died, you know, by the end of the first winter.
On top of probably losing half of them on the ship on the way over in the first place. So they're probably down to like a quarter of them after the first winter of what they originally had left with.
well, yeah. There was one suicide. There was something they called the general sickness that went through the people who had come on the ship, and the sailors and the ship actually had to stay there and winter because they ended up not getting to, as we know, they didn't get to Plymouth until or get to New England, which they thought was Virginia at the time. Until the end of November, and they didn't start like actually building their shelters on land until the end of December. So they had terrible, like they really had like no shelter.
Did they leave the boat to like hunt and stuff, or do they try to like maintain on supplies that they had on the ship already?
They spent a lot of time just, like the men from the ship, of course, spent a lot of time wandering around, kind of exploring. And one of the very first things they did was to dig up an Indian grave.
Smart.
Yes. Yeah, so respectful. That's a good, great start there.
We all know the weird paranormal stuff that ends up happening when you do that. So that's a great start of landing in a new land. Let's dig up a grave.
Exactly. It's all downhill from there. And one of the next things they did was to steal a bunch of corn that the native people had buried for winter. They stole that. And the pot it came in, I believe, and they also shot at some Indians that they saw who had like come to try and figure out, you know, what they were doing. They wanted to send the message that, you know, we're dangerous and don't mess with us, basically. And it was mostly the Wampanoag people who were in the area. And so anyway, the Europeans, they did not make a very good impression, you know. So it was kind of par for the course as far as how a relationship with the indigenous peoples and the European people would go, and how the European people would treat and view the people who were already here occupying the land. And American Witches kind of ties in with that, because by the end of the 1600s, people were being executed as witches in Salem, and on several occasions before Salem as well. And that was like a very, very nasty combination of superstition, some folklore, and religion. A lot of religion played into it more than anything. The witch book also gets into some other great witch stories from America. Instances where people were accused of being witches or claimed to be witches. Things like I don't know if you've heard of Booger Hole, West Virginia.
I don't think that I have.
No. it's not really a place anymore, but like the beginning of the 1900s, there was accusations of witchcraft going on, and just a lot of weirdness going on in that area.
Guess they should have learned to store their rye properly so that they weren't getting the argot. And it's argot, right? That's how you say it. They were getting the fungus on the rye that was causing them to have like psychedelic effects from it. And then they were seeing stuff that wasn't necessarily happening as they perceived it.
Mm-hmm. I think there was like some research done on that. And I don't think that they've kind of have landed on that as being what it ultimately was. It's the accusations like in Salem originated, you know, with these young girls, but what the girls, the symptoms of their possession and bewitchment were very much like the symptoms that had been described by Increase and Cotton Mather, mainly Cotton Mather at that point, the Reverend, Boston Reverend, who had already written about cases of witchcraft and bewitchment in Europe, and also an alleged case that had happened in Boston of the Goodman children some years before Salem. And the girls in Salem pretty much imitated a lot of the things that that were in these books. And they may not have actually read the books themselves, but certainly they would have heard the stories. I mean, there wasn't a lot of, you know, literature going around in New England at the time. Certainly that would have been something that would have caught the attention of children and young girls.
I mean, I'm assuming it's probably built into their folklore regardless, just coming from Europe, because a lot of people, they associate the witch trials with America, but it was just as prevalent over in Europe. And on top of that, they had all like the werewolf trials in Europe where they were accusing people of being werewolves. So it's like it was already heavily built into their folklore. So, of course, it was just going to get carried on over here. And in turn, anybody starts doing anything weird, people are going to start pointing the finger, even if, you know, a lot of the time it could have just been like a neighbor somebody didn't like, or a young girl that they didn't like because maybe they tried to make some type of advancement and she didn't have it, so they couldn't have that coming back on them, so then they accuse them of being a witch. Like, I think there's a lot of personal reasons on top of all of that on why people are being accused.
There were a lot of grudges associated with according to who was being accused, and I'll definitely people use the opportunity to get back at people but there were also like other things at play, like the terrible relationship between the colonists and the early people of New England, and the local native population. There were had been, you know, by the time of Salem, there had already been like, you know, attacks, wars with the Indians, basically. And one of the girls, one of the first girls to become possessed, had actually was living with a family that wasn't her family. Her family had been killed in an attack by Indians, and which she had presumably witnessed. And she had been held hostage. People would be like held and then ransomed, and it was very, very complex and more than what, you know, I even, you know, I'm not an authority or scholar to speak on it, but it was a lot to do with the French who were settling, you know, in the Canadian areas, and the French were had a lot to gain by enlisting the local native peoples into, you know, helping to fight against the English who were in places where the French wanted to be.
Yeah, just trying to fight for territory, essentially, and just taking advantage of the land and the people that are already there, and probably offering them goods and this and that in order to fight. Because, I mean, Native Americans didn't have guns. So, I mean, that's like the ultimate thing to trade right there. If you're European, you just offer them guns, and then makes their hunting a million times easier, makes protecting their fortifications a million times easier. So you can pretty much get them to do anything if you offer them some type of magic boomstick that's just going to knock down any animal without any type of, you know, trying to understand archery or anything like that.
Right. They, I mean, of course, the, you know, European settlers exploited, you know, all of the indigenous peoples, you know, in every way they could possibly, you know, think of.
A lot of dark history that gets covered up. They don't really get taught in school. I mean, there was a lot of like the settlers and stuff giving them blankets that were infested with diseases that they weren't familiar with, just to take them out of certain areas so that they could take over the land. Again, manipulation of the people in order to attack other people so that you could take over those settlements. Like, there's a lot of dark history involved with all of that that tends to get left out in a lot of history until you really start digging into it.
So much dark history. And by the time by the time colonies were established, even there are estimates that over 90% of the original indigenous population of the Americas had already died off, like was reduced by that much, by the diseases brought from Europe and by the murders and the other exploitation. I mean, people were, you know, stolen, you know, from, you know, America and taken to Europe and other places, you know, to be slaves. And so
makes you wonder how many tribes may have been forgotten in the process of that happening, that we were never even aware that they even existed, just because of the fact that most of the natives were nomadic. So it's like there wasn't buildings to rediscover their history, anything. So essentially, if they were wiped out, there's nothing left. Nobody even knows they even existed, because nothing's really left besides like possibly like burial areas or whatever.
Right, right. I mean, we tend to, you know, think of the indigenous peoples as they were like when the Europeans got here, you know, and that's like, you know, the snapshot of like, okay, this is how it was, but, you know, they've been there for thousands of years, you know, they were, you know,
that was probably nowhere near the peak. That was like the downfall of their society, essentially.
Basically, yes. Yeah, thanks to the Europeans. Yeah, for sure.
Divide and conquer. Conquest. It goes a long way and destroys a lot of things.
It definitely does. It definitely does. Especially when you bring a lot of diseases. And then, not to change the subject, but the Mysteries in Northwestern Maryland is about local legends and lore from this part of the state of Maryland, which is Western Maryland. And there's a lot of colorful history in this area. And not the least of which is the Snarty Owl. And by that, I don't mean our friend Dave, the Snarly Owl. I mean, there was an actual creature called the Snarly Owl in Maryland. So that's one of our good cryptids here.
There hasn't been a sighting because it is Dave. Dave transforms into the Snarly Owl.
It's possible.
Has anybody asked Dave how old he is, how long he's been here for?
I don't know. He's mysterious.
Mysteriously nice. That's the funny part.
He is. He really is. He's too nice. He's not snarly.
So I know on this show, I haven't dived too far into like the cryptids of Maryland. So if you'd like to, I'd like to kind of do a little touch on each of them if you'd like, you know, as far as some of your favorite ones that you possibly covered in the book, or just like the most prolific ones in the area, maybe even some of the paranormal stuff. But for anybody that may not be familiar with like the background of Maryland's folklore, might as well give them kind of like a round view of a bunch of different folklore as far as Maryland goes.
Okie doke. Well, I will start with the Snarly Owl, because the cool thing about the Snarly Owl is the Snarly Owl actually has his own wayside marker here along the road in Washington County. It's kind of on the border of Frederick and Washington County. And there's a wayside marker that's shows the National Road, which was one of the earliest roads in the country. And the Snarly Owl has his very own panel. And I should be able to just show you real quick. This is a close-up of the panel on the wayside marker. And it says, "Beware of the Snarly Owl." It says, "Legend has it that the shadow of a black dog used to prowl the heights of South Mountain. One night, a huntsman famous as a sure shot encountered the beast. He aimed and fired his rifle. The shot went right through the animal with no effect. He fired again and again, each shot passing through the shadowy beast. Finally, overcome with dread, the huntsman fled." Which is pretty cool. This guy looks a little bit like a mangy wolf or something. I don't think it really does the Snarly Owl justice, but it's still very cool to see like a cryptid type monster on a historical marker along the road. And the reason that we know about all this stuff about the Snarly Owl is because in the 1880s, a woman named Madeline Vinton Dahlgren bought an old inn along the National Road outside of Boonesboro and turned it into her summer house. And she was an author, and she was very interested in all the local legends and lore that the mountain-dwelling folks, whom she didn't think super highly of, by the way. She was very interested in all their legends, and all they would tell her stories about all the different hauntings and unexplained cryptid type creatures. And she actually collected the stories and put them together and made a book, South Mountain Magic. And in the book, she actually interviewed local people, and like the story from the wayside marker comes from her book. And that was the person that that's happened to, that tried to fight the snarly owl. Actually told her that story firsthand. And there were like quite a few people who gave her their accounts of confronting the snarly yowl. So, in addition to the guy who tried shooting him, there was another man who told her that he tried to fight it, and that he said his fists would go right through the beast. And the snarly owl is kind of a version of like the very common like black dog, kind of like a ghost slash cryptid. And those stories definitely, you know, came from the old country. And but not just that, like really like all over the world, like, you know, it is a very common cryptid or ghost, depending on how you want to look at it. But like a large black dog is definitely like a real archetype of cryptid for folklore. And
like Black Shuck is a prime example as far as like European goes.
Right.
But it seems like just the idea of a big black ghostly dog seems very native folklore. So it's kind of like a weird mix between that. Like I'm sure that natives had their own variation of these black dog apparitions that would exist in America. But again, it happened in Europe too. So it's like, there's this idea that it seems like it's like an international phenomenon that seems to be talked about everywhere, and it has different roots everywhere. So who knows where like it originated from necessarily. I feel like it all kind of blended together at a certain point, and now we kind of assume it to be with European folklore, even though it's more than likely a mix of both.
Right. Yeah. I mean, definitely like, you know, I'm pretty sure I've read, you know, versions of it from, you know, like.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Far Eastern countries and, you know, everywhere. Just like how, you know, the different cultures might have different versions of the flood, you know, story or whatever, you know, the Great Flood. You know, which could be lumped with folklore. But, so quite a few people told Madeline Dahlgren that, you know, they had encountered the snarly owl. It chased, the people talked about it chasing them. But it seemed to be like the idea of the snarly owl seemed to be that he kind of was guarding the national road and didn't like letting folks pass by. It seemed to be a pretty common experience, according to the people who lived on South Mountain back then.
Sounds like a native spirit trying to like block off territory or something. So see, even with that, it just sounds very like native to me, because it kind of has that idea that you hear with a lot of American folklore, that it's something native based that was created, summoned in order to keep people away from a specific area because it's a sacred ground, for example.
Right. It would be really great, you know, to know, you know, like what sort of folklore, you know, came from the indigenous people in the, you know, here in this area. I mean, like the earliest, you know, people that, you know, I know about are just like, Iroquois, who were kind of pushed into this area, you know, by the whole, you know, Europeans coming and stirring things up and, you know, different tribes and Indian nations fighting with each other and sort of moving further down into this area. And, you know, obviously, there's not a whole lot known about, you know, who was here, like, you know, before that.
All the native stuff is all oral folklore. So as soon as right. a group passes away, somebody doesn't pass on the story, then it's essentially gone at that point.
Right. And when so many people, so much of the population was literally killed off at once, like so much, you know, just like expired. I mean, not at once, but over the course of, you know, decades, literally. You know, it's just like so much of that folklore.
See, you know, kind of a weird thing to think about, and I don't know if you necessarily know the answer to this, but with a lot of native words, it seems like there's multiple spellings for those. And considering everything was an oral tradition, I mean, again, I don't know for sure. I'm just kind of guessing here, but I'm assuming that there wasn't necessarily a written language as far as native language goes. And the characters that people started creating, like I said, multiple spellings for one native word, I'm assuming came from English settlers, European settlers in general coming mm-hmm. and then trying to create a written variation of that language. But for the natives, I don't think that there is necessarily like a written language, right?
I don't know a lot about it, but I don't think there is a lot of that. No, but I think that, like, I know that, like, in New England, like, on trails, like, through the woods, you know, that the natives had been using, they would, like, put, like, posts sometimes that might have certain markings on them, and that would kind of tell a story about something that had happened there, like, marking something, like...
Yeah, it's like symbols and drawings instead of actual like characters being written out.
Uh-huh. And I don't know at all as much as I'd like to or should or understand as much, you know, about, you know, the indigenous cultures and history. I really don't. But, I mean, there are definitely, you know, dog-like creatures in native folklore that we know about, some very creepy ones.
And I'm sure a lot were probably lost too because of just how many natives were passing away all at once because of all the different diseases they brought over. So I'm sure that the stuff that we do know about as far as native creatures and folklore goes is probably only like 20% of what did exist throughout history.
Right. And like when the, especially when New England was settled, you know, from my reading, you know, about the Pilgrims and the Pilgrims, like, William Bradford, you know, left, he was kind of like their, you know, leader. And, you know, there were a lot of written accounts left by them. And one of the main things they were interested in as far as writing was translating the Bible so that the native people could understand it and, you know, become what they called praying Indians. That was their goal.
I guess that's probably one of the first goals when it comes to conquest is they want to get, especially back in the day, they wanted to get everybody into their religious views because they saw everybody as savages for having multiple deities, multiple gods. They wanted everybody to be on that same practice. And if not, they would just slaughter them.
Right. Yep. And, you know, they felt they were doing the Lord's work, you know, but that was another way they used to justify, you know, trying to conquer the people, you know, because they were trying to, you know, bring them to whatever religion.
That's why all their native grounds are called the devil's this, the devil's that, the devil's that, is because they're just trying to demonize their entire culture. I mean, that's even essentially what happened with the Wendigo. I know I've talked about it a few times in the show, but like the whole idea of like what the Wendigo looks like is nothing like what the natives described. And I think that the whole idea about when it had the skull and the horns and all of that was because of Europeans telling the story and then trying to have that demonic connotation involved into their folklore, even though, again, a Wendigo would be more of like a zombie-like looking creature than it would be, you know, like a half man, half beast, skull-headed, antlered creature.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that, but it's sounds about right. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Because usually what people talk about is like rakes or pale crawlers, if you're familiar with any of those terms, are generally like how the natives would have described like the Wendigos. So I think that a lot of the Wendigo, you know, a lot of the cases where people describe seeing pale crawlers or
creepy.
Yeah, just any of those things that are rakes that it's that more than likely those are probably actually like the Wendigos that the natives talk about. Like, I don't know if you kind of look at this stuff as, you know, being just the folklore aspect of it, or if there's actually like a belief that some of this stuff might actually exist. But at least for me, I believe that some of this stuff definitely exists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of my connotation on it, is that a lot of people talk about pale crawlers or rakes. Not a lot of people have Wendigo experiences, but I think it's because they're looking at the wrong archetype for like what they're actually experiencing, right, or seeing. So then they created a whole new subsection of folklore for something that already existed.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always kind of can't rule out the idea that, you know, enough people believing, you know, in something like can kind of make it, you know,
like a tulpa. Real. Yeah. People, enough belief starts actually manifesting and creating it. Cause for all we know, reality is completely malleable. And I mean, we could essentially create our reality through thoughts and through perception.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And, you know, I think that's a big, it's even part of, you know, a lot of religions to look at things that way. So,
and whatever belief background you have, you kind of incorporate stuff to fit into that paradigm and matter of perspective on what you're seeing. Like all the native Definitely. Creatures being perceived as demons or this or that, versus even people with like who are, you know, heavily religious believing that extraterrestrials now are like demons and things like that. It's just, it all fits in your paradigm in some way, shape, or form. But regardless of what belief and background you're coming from, there is a weird phenomenon happening and there is some type of weird creature that's existing. And it's just a matter of which box you want to try to put it into.
Right, right. And definitely like the Indians, like the when they first encountered the Jesuits in Canada and upper like New York area, when the priests came over and they had like their little kits to like do communion and all this kind of stuff, indigenous people there like weren't too sure that the Jesuits weren't demons, or, you know, to them they thought what the priests were doing was seemed like witchcraft. So, you know, so
it's all a matter of perspective.
definitely. I mean, it seemed like I definitely, you know, you can see how it would seem like a lot of like magic, you know, hoodoo kind of stuff. Like, you know, we're going to turn this water into this wine into blood and, you know, all that. Like, it's could be taken as being pretty out there.
I mean, a lot of that stuff too could literally be a science that just wasn't understood at the time. So, I mean, like, you take wine and maybe you add something to it and it coagulates and looks like blood, and then there you go, you just did some type of witchcraft when realistically all you did was add like a certain herb to a wine and then it totally changed like the matter of the substance, you know.
Right.
Thicken it up a bit, add some flour to it.
There you go. Oh gosh. So, anyway, back to the black dogs. Yes, that's definitely like a real archetype of, you know, ghost / cryptid. And we definitely enforce here. There's also, something called a dwayo, which was said to be in Frederick County. And this was somewhere around 1970-ish. And it was reported in the local newspaper that a man had called the police and said that he had just gotten into like a fist fight with like this creature that he called a dwayo on his property. And it sort of snowballed after that. The newspaper kind of ran with it and kept, going around and interviewing people about what did they think about the Dwayo and had they seen one. And then some people were going to do a Dwayo hunt and try and track it down. And that didn't quite get off the ground. So it was kind of an unresolved circumstance. It was never really concluded if the guy even existed, the guy who said, supposedly called the police, or if it was someone's idea of a joke somewhere along the way. There are definitely always plenty of colorful characters around who, like, he may have been somebody who very well thought that he did fight a Dwayo in his backyard.
I mean, you may never even find that thing if you start going into, like, the German folklore of it, that there was that guy who came who was supposedly, like, a wizard, had, like, the spell book, and could turn into this dog-like creature. So, I mean, like, if it is more on, like, the werewolf side than, like, the straight dog side, I mean, you may never find the thing, because it's not going to be necessarily always in the dog form.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely, like, what he described, definitely, you know, sounded like a dog, what we call dog man, you know, today. So, who knows? I mean, there have been other reports, you know, over the years of people seeing something kind of like that in kind of the Frederick County, Catoctin Mountain kind of area. So, who knows?
I mean, that associates with a lot of native stuff, too, because you have, like, the, I don't remember what the native word for it is, but there was the English variation, because I couldn't say the correct word, which I think was, like, oolong dog or something like that, but they started calling it the long dog, which essentially is this, like, wolf or werewolf dogman-like creature that would give off this, like, sulfur smell, and they said it could change its form into, like, the form of, like, a human and stuff. So it's just, like, that's something that I feel exists in, again, folklore a little bit of everywhere, that the natives had their variation. You even had, like, the Sioux dogmen warriors that they said would literally turn into dogs, and then going into Europe you have all the werewolf culture. So it's like you have two sides of that too. So it's like maybe there's a possibility of it, or there's always the option that I usually say on the show, that, again, perception is malleable. So if there are creatures like this, like skinwalkers are another kind of example of it, I don't think that they're necessarily completely changing their form, but rather maybe they have this understanding on how to change somebody's perception of what they're seeing. So rather than them actually twisting and contorting and turning into a dog, rather they're wearing like a dog skin and they're able to change people's perception of what they're seeing, thinking that they're seeing a dog in front of them when it's actually a person wearing like a dog fur on their back, for example.
Right, right. That's a cool concept. Definitely, definitely.
Especially being in the dark, too, because, I mean, I'm sure a lot of these encounters have happened at night. If you see somebody crawling around the ground wearing a dog fur, you know, you're going to be like, wow, that's a weird-looking dog. I need to get away from this thing.
Definitely. I know I have a really good imagination that's just, like, ready to fill in the blanks anytime, you know.
Especially in the dark, the human brain will start filling in gaps really quick.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. That's for sure. One of the other kind of classic and more well-known cryptids in the Western Maryland area is, of course, the Snallygaster. And that story originated in 1909. And it was reported right after there had been a big outbreak of Jersey Devil sightings up in that area. And then the Middletown Valley Register in Frederick County kind of jumped on the bandwagon, except there, at first they said it was the Jersey Devil heading towards Maryland. But then they went on to change it into like a totally different independent creature. It was a very large flying dragon-like creature, and a description of it, let's see, it was a creature with enormous wings, a long pointed tail, a long pointed bill, four legs with claws like steel hooks, a screech like a locomotive whistle, a pointed tail 20 feet long. And the newspaper in Middletown reported that this, on its way to the Middletown Valley in Frederick County, that it had killed a man, and it said that it had punctured the man's jugular vein, carried him off, punctured his jugular vein, and sucked out all his blood, and then tossed his body off the hillside.
It's the New England chupacabra.
Maybe so. Western Maryland chupacabra. And there were quite a lot of articles about it. And of course, it was picked up and reported all over the area. And eventually, a couple months after the creature was first reported on, it was said to have, after attacking some folks at the train depot in Emmitsburg, in a different part of the county, it had kind of flown off, but it had laid eggs somewhere in the area. So, you know, it was kind of a da-da-da.
Set out a search party. Everybody's looking for some Snallygaster eggs.
Yes. But the thing about the Snallygaster was there's a lot of, you know, the legend of, you know, that there was the Snallygaster, and, you know, it was very cool looking how they described it, and all kinds of colorful stories associated with it. However, the first article that the Middletown Valley Register published about the Snallygaster, when it was saying that it was on its way and heading for this area, the headline was literally "The colored people are in great danger." And it turned out that, according to the Middletown Valley Register, the Snallygaster only ate black people, specifically black men. Specifically black men who might be wanting to vote, because they could vote at the time. They were strongly encouraged to stay home, and because this dangerous creature was out there just waiting to eat them. And
manipulating folklore into your own malicious needs and wants of society. Right. Like, I didn't even know that part about the Snallygaster. That's something new I didn't actually know before.
Yeah, that actually, there is no record of the Snallygaster before 1909. This was literally the Snallygaster. It was created by this newspaper, by the editor and reporter at the Middletown Valley Register, who later admitted that they made it up. They didn't say why, but
it got enough of national attention, though, that even, like, I know I've said it a bunch of times with Teddy Roosevelt on the show being like the cryptid hunter, but Teddy Roosevelt went looking for the Jersey Devil, and he went looking for the Snallygaster.
That there was, like, something reported that the government was going to send a troop of United States soldiers and a Gatling gun to the area to hunt the creature. And it was reported that President Roosevelt was so anxious to see the monster, he may postpone his African trip until it can be captured.
Can't send in the cavalry without Roosevelt. Yeah,
guess not. And that was in 1909. In 1932, the legend was revived, and kind of to coincide with the end of Prohibition. The editor at the Valley Register, the fun spoiling editor at the Valley Register, they were basically prohibitionists. They supported prohibition. The Snallygaster reappeared in 1932, right about the time when the Volstead Act was repealed and prohibition was going to end in 1933. And the Snallygaster ended up at a moonshine still drinking moonshine and accidentally fell in and died in the moonshine still.
After first going blind, of course.
Definitely. So at that point, that was the demise of the Snallygaster. But of course, the legend has lived on, and most people who hear about the Snallygaster, it seems like a fun monster because it's this huge, flying, wacky thing. There was a newspaper had a drawing of the Snallygaster riding a bicycle, and it was just like all kinds of crazy stuff, It was like kind of a goofy, lunkhead, lovable kind of monster. But very few people know of the actual origins of it. The Snallygaster, as we know him today, for almost everybody who's ever heard of the Snallygaster doesn't know the origin story, and so he has a separate life aside from its his terrible, shameful creation origin story. He was kind of became a crowdsourced monster, because the legend got elaborated on, and his appearance would be changed by different stories, and he had one eye in the middle of his forehead at one point, and so he's still kind of revered as a lovable kind of legend, kind of a cryptid, aside from in a way it's kind of become separated from that original Snallygaster that was created by the Middletown Valley Register in 1909.
Some true American folklore. It's like a mixture of everything, but it's a good thing in my opinion that it got pulled away from the negative connotation of it, because now it's something that new generations of folklore / cryptid researchers can enjoy without necessarily it being instantly attached to the negative side of what it was representing at the time.
Mm-hmm. I definitely wouldn't want to cancel the Snallygaster or anything, but it is good for people to know where stories can originate sometimes. But the ideal thing would have been if it would have like come to life and gone after the editors who created him. That would have been fun.
that would have just been karma at its finest, in all fairness. Yes. You created me, so now I must destroy you.
Yeah, it's kind of a typical moment in American folklore, as with lots of American history. It's just a lot of dark ugliness there,
Darkness hidden underneath the surface.
Yeah. Yeah, or not so. In this case, there was, a blaring headline that was elaborated on at great length throughout, the articles. But, America, we just have a lot of problematic history, and a lot of our a good history is still tainted with, you know, we have George Washington, but he had slaves, you know, so.
It's just, Thomas Jefferson being known to regularly have intercourse and children with his slaves. So, like, that's something that gets left out of history a lot, too, is how many people of African descent actually have lineage with Jefferson.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, there are just a lot of dark blots on American history, you know.
Wasn't Washington's teeth, too? They weren't actually, like, wood like everybody thought they were. Didn't he have, like, dentures made out of, like, slave teeth, too?
He had, yes, like, enslaved people and free black people, too, I assume, you know, could actually sell their teeth. Washington definitely had teeth that had been pulled out of enslaved or maybe in some cases free blackmen's mouths. Yes.
Something that will definitely get left out of history. They want everybody to believe he had a wooden set of teeth instead of actually realizing the truth that more than likely his full denture set was probably pulled from his slaves that he owned at the time directly.
I think he tried everything. Anything, you know, like that. I mean, that was like cutting edge, you know, then, I'm sure. He had like a lot of interactions with dentists, particularly, you know, one that he counted on, you know, where he was just desperate, you know, to do anything for teeth. You know, they must have been very, very much plagued by, you know, by dental pain and.
I mean, on top of just your public figure, of course, you want to be able to present yourself without trying to hide your mouth or not, you know, let people see your teeth. You want to be able to smile at the public, you know, kind of hard to do if half your teeth are missing or rotted out.
I could see how it could make you pretty grumpy. Couldn't have been fun having teeth implanted. Mm-mm. Yeah, I mean, it's not fun today, like when they do stuff like that.
Yeah, back then it was a lot. More gritty, like they're probably taking literally some type of adhesive and putting it right into the holes in your gums where the previous teeth were, like, and they probably didn't stay in very well. They probably weren't comfortable. You'd probably eat and your teeth would shift and fall back out and you'd have to get them re-put back in. Like, imagine that. On top of the fact that, again, you have people's teeth from other people's mouths that you're putting in the holes where your teeth should be.
And I think they, like, I think Washington might have had like some metal hinges on his dentures and just awful stuff. Awful. Yeah.
So, I guess with that, I always like to do words of wisdom before we start wrapping everything up. So if there is any words of wisdom, you'd like to bestow on the listeners, what might it be?
Definitely take care of your teeth.
Number one, first and foremost.
Lessons from our founding fathers, very important. I would just say, like, if you could just find the most fascinating things that you could ever possibly read by reading old, like, first person accounts in history, you know, of whether it be of people, you know, in the wagon trains heading west, or people, you know, who, you know, came to Jamestown or to New England, or people who were accused of being witches, or just your average things in old newspapers. Like, so many amazing stories that will make you think differently about American history and what life was like, and how good we have it, many of us today. Even on our worst days, we have it a lot better than a lot of early people, you know, in this country.
Keep true history and folklore alive. That's kind of what I try to do a lot on the show, is just if you keep these stories in circulation, then they won't end up getting lost to time, and you give them a new medium to exist in. Instead of just being in an old book that might get put on a shelf, completely forgotten about, bring it into the digital future and have it in podcasts, have it in digital books. Like, just keep the folklore and everything alive, because if not, it's just going to get lost into time like everything else.
There you go. Definitely.
And with that too, if anybody wants to pick up any of your books, possibly contact you about maybe sharing some local stories from Maryland, anything like that, where can people find you on the internet and where can people find your books on the internet?
People can contact me probably easiest on Instagram. And you can look for Susan Fair on Instagram. My at is Sucafa, S-U-C-A-F-A. First two letters of my initials is what that is. And you can find my email address there as well. And I love to hear from anyone anytime. And my books always ideal to go through local booksellers, but also convenient. They're all available on Amazon too.
Perfect.
And I thank you so much for having me, and thanks to anybody listening. And it's super fun to talk about history and weirdness. The intersection of history and weirdness is awesome.
Oh, absolutely. That's my bread and butter, of course. And of course, I will include all of your links down in the show description so everybody can find everything really quick and easy. And I really appreciate you making the time to come on. This has been a great conversation. And I'm looking forward to hopefully seeing you next year at one of Dave's events in West Virginia slash Maryland.
For sure. The Snarly Owl. We know so much more about the Snarly Owl now.
I know for sure I'll be at the Halloween event. So at least maybe I'll see you there if you're vending there. So.
Absolutely. If I'm not vending, I'll be shopping.
Hopefully, if you're there, I'll have to contact you ahead of time. Maybe then I can pick up a signed copy of one of your books next time I get to go and see you in West Virginia, too.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Great. If you guys enjoyed this episode, don't forget to leave a review or rating for the show on iTunes or Spotify or whatever other podcatcher that you use. And of course, you guys can also share the show through word of mouth. If you think somebody might really enjoy this episode, you guys can share it with them directly. Or you guys can go on the YouTube or the TikTok, share some different clips of the show. Maybe you can get somebody interested off of watching a little short form version of the show. But anything you guys do, greatly appreciate it. And if you don't do any of that, I just appreciate that you guys are listening to the show. And if anybody has an encounter to report, no matter how big, no matter how small, you guys can report that to OMMEncounterReports@outlook.com. Or you guys can go to the link tree, and there is a specific submission form for that. And if you guys want to get a hold of me for any other reason whatsoever, you guys can do so through social media. Instagram is the one that I'm the most active on, or Facebook. Or you guys can also email me at inquiriesofourrealitypodcast@outlook.com. Or you guys can go to the link tree, fill the submission form for that. There is two separate submission forms, so make sure you guys click on the right one. And of course, make sure you guys check your spam or junk folders, because I do respond to every single message that I get. But due to the fact that I send out a lot of links for the show, a lot of the time my stuff gets pushed to the spam or junk folders. But anyways, just make sure you guys check, of course, because I don't want anything to get missed going back and forth with you guys. But everything that I mentioned is all available on the link tree, which is available down in the show description. And with that, hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. And I'll catch you on the next one. Have a good night, everybody.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.